Good morning, everybody. I hope you had a good night. My name is Ulf Martin. I have the pleasure to moderate this first session of a track that consists of 9 sessions. It's called Capital as Power, and the first session will be by Jonathan Nitzen alone, unfortunately, because Tim Schumacher couldn't make it. Well, I just give the word to you, and you just continue with the rest.
Okay.
Yeah. I think we will have
to
talk for an hour, and then we can get into a discussion. But of course, I think you can ask any questions if you don't understand. So please.
Okay. Thank you very much, Ulf. This is the first in a series of panels, as you indicated, which we organized to coincide with the publication of Capital as Power, a book that Shimshon Bichler and myself published in May of 2009. Very briefly, the series comprises 9 integrated panels, and you have here copies of the timetable and the abstracts. And the book itself supposedly is available at the conference for those of you who are interested. The structure of the panels, very briefly, is as follows. This will be the opening presentation that will set the stage. The following 2 panels, panel 2 and 3, will assess the framework concepts and methods, critically, of the theory of capital as power. And I'll be sitting on those panels as a participant, so hopefully that will give me further opportunity to elaborate beyond what I can do in an hour here. The next 5 panels 4 to 8, will present new research and new thinking about various aspects of capital as power. And the 9th, and in my opinion the most important panel, is a roundtable, the purpose of which is to discuss future research and future organization of research dealing with capital as power. And of course, this is an open roundtable and everybody is invited. Now let's get directly to the topic of the presentation and speak about cosmology. As Marx tells us, the capitalist regime is inextricably bound up with its theories and ideologies. These theories and ideologies, first articulated by classical political economy, are more than a passive attempt to simply explain, justify, and critique the so-called economic system. Instead, they constitute an entire cosmology. They constitute a system of thinking that is both active and totalizing. In ancient Greek, kosmeo has an active connotation. It means to order, means to organize. And political economy does precisely that. It explains, justifies, and critiques the world, but it also actively makes this world in the first place. And it pertains not to the narrow economy as such, but to the entire social order, as well as to the natural universe in which this social order is embedded. The purpose of my presentation is to outline an alternative cosmology, to outline the beginning of a totally different framework for understanding capitalism. Now, to suggest an alternative, of course, we first need to know what is the thing that we contest and seek to replace. Therefore, I'll begin my talk by spelling out what I think are the hallmarks of the present capitalist cosmology. Following this initial step, I'll enumerate the reasons why, over the past century, this cosmology gradually disintegrated to the point of being really unable to understand and recreate its world. And finally, in the last part of the presentation, I'll articulate some of the key themes of our own theory, the theory of capital as power. Political economy, liberal as well as Marxist, stands on 3 key foundations that I will first list and then try to unzip. The first foundation is the separation between economics and politics. The second foundation is the Galilean, Cartesian, Newtonian mechanical understanding of the economy itself. And the third foundation is a value theory that breaks the economy into 2 spheres, real and nominal, and that uses the quantities of the real sphere to explain the appearances of the nominal sphere. Now, let's examine each of these three foundations more closely, beginning with the first one, the separation of economics and politics. During the 13th and 14th century, there emerged in the city-states of Italy and the Low Countries an alternative to the rural feudal regime. This alternative was the urban order of the capitalist bourg. The rulers of the bourg were the capitalists. They were the owners of money. They were the owners of the trading houses and the ships. They were the managers of industry, the enterprising pursuers of new social technologies, the seekers of innovative methods of production. Now, these early capitalists offered an entirely new way of organizing society. Instead of the vertical feudal order, in which privilege and income were obtained by force and legitimized and sanctified by religion, they brought a flat civil order, an order in which privilege and income came from rational productivity. Instead of a closed loop of agricultural redistribution by confiscation, they promised an open-ended industrial growth. Instead of ignorance, they brought progress and knowledge. Instead of subservience, they offered opportunity. Theirs was the future regime of capital, an economic order based on an endless cycle of production and consumption and an ever-growing accumulation of money. Now, initially, the bourg was subservient to the feudal order in which it emerged, but that status gradually changed. The bourg began to demand and obtain libertates. I hope I'm pronouncing it correctly. That is, differential exceptions from feudal penalties, feudal taxes, feudal levies. The bourgeoisie recognized the legitimacy of feudal politics, particularly in areas and matters of religion and war. But it demanded that these aspects of politics do not impinge on its urban economy. Now, this early class struggle, the power conflict between the declining nobility on the one hand and the rising bourgeoisie on the other hand, is, we claim, the origin of what we now consider as the separation of economics and politics. The features of this separation are worth summarizing, beginning with the liberal view. Over the past half millennium, liberals have grown accustomed to classifying production, technology, trade, income, profit as aspects of the economy. By contrast, entities such as state, law, army, violence have been classified as belonging to politics. The economy is taken to be the productive sphere. This is the realm of individual freedom, of rationality, frugality, and it's a dynamic sphere. It creates output, it raises consumption, it moves society forward. By contrast, politics is conceived as coercive collective. It's corrupt, it's wasteful, it's conservative. It is a parasitical sphere that latches onto the economy and it taxes it and intervenes in its efficient operations. Now, ideally, the economy should be left to its own. Laissez-faire politics would produce the most efficient economic outcome. But then, in practice, this is never the case. Political intervention, we are told, constantly distorts the economy, undermining its efficient operations. So the liberal equation becomes clear and simple. The best society is one with the most economics and the least politics. Now, the Marxist view. Marxists view this separation rather differently, but not entirely differently. For Marx, the liberal dichotomy between civil society and state is misleading. It's a misleading ideal, if not outright self-deception. The political legal structure, he says, is not separate from but integral to the material economy. The bureaucracy of the state legitimizes capital. It gives its accumulation a universal form. It maintains the overall framework of the capitalist system. However, when Marx comes to construct his own capitalist system, theoretically, he really ends up retaining the dual structure. There's a material economic base of exploitation, and that base is supported by state and legal institutions that rely on what he calls oppression. Now, following the footsteps of his classical predecessors, particularly Adam Smith and David Ricardo, Marx too prioritizes economics over politics. The productive sphere, and especially the labor process, he argues, is the engine of social development. This is where use value is created, where surplus value is generated, where capital is accumulated. Production for Marx is the fountainhead. It's the ultimate source from which the other spheres of society draw. They draw their energy from that source, and this is energy which they in turn use to help shape and sustain the sphere of production on which they so depend themselves. And so, although for Marx, capitalist economics and politics are deeply intertwined, their interaction is one of two conceptually distinct entities. So this is the first foundation, the separation of politics and economics. The second foundation of political economy is the Galilean, Cartesian, Newtonian model. The new capitalist order emerged hand in hand with a political scientific revolution, a revolution that was marked by a mechanical worldview, a worldview that was spelled out by Machiavelli, by Kepler, by Galileo, Descartes, Hobbes, Locke, Hume, Leibniz, and of course, most importantly of all, Newton. It is common to argue that political economists have borrowed their metaphors and methods from the natural sciences. But we should note that the opposite is equally true, if not more so. In other words, that the worldview of the scientist reflected their society. Let me give you a few examples. Galileo and Newton were deeply inspired by Machiavelli's Prince. The prince relentlessly pursues secular power for the sake of power. His concern is not the general good, his concern is order and stability. And he achieves his goals not with divine help, but through systematic application of calculated rationality. Now, Hobbes' mechanical human being was modeled after Galileo's pendulum that swings between the quest for power on the one hand and fear of death on the other. But then Galileo's own mechanical cosmos was itself a reflection of a society increasingly pervaded by machines. Newton could make up a world of independent bodies because he lived in a society that began to critique hierarchical power and praise and glorify individualism. He envisaged a liberal world in which every body is a lonely soul in the cosmos, interacting but never dictating its will on other bodies. There is really no ultimate cause in Newton. There's only interdependence. Descartes could emphasize the immediacy of cause and effect. In other words, that leaves move only because the wind touches them, because he lived in a world that increasingly contested religion and the church invoked miracles that operate at a distance. Antoine Lavoisier invented the law of conservation of matter while he was building a wall around Paris, turning it into a sealed container so that he could capture the mass of taxable income. Darwin's survival of the fittest was based on Malthus's population theory, and so on and so forth. Now, these recent examples should not really surprise us. Human beings tend to impose on the cosmos the power structure that governs their own society. In other words, and this is quite important, they tend to politicize nature. In archaic societies, the gods usually are numerous, they are relatively equal, and they are highly omnipotent. Hierarchical status regimes tend to impose a pantheon of gods, and absolute rule tends to insist on a single God and a monotheistic religion. In each case, the forces that make up nature reflect, and in turn are reflected, by the forces that shape society. Now, capitalism, we argue, is no exception to this historical rule. Consider the mechanical worldview. The liberal God is nothing but absolute rationality or natural law. The language of God is mathematical, and therefore the structure of the universe is numerical. The universe that God created is flat. It is filled with numerous bodies that are not subservient and dependent, but are free and interdependent. These bodies are propelled not by differential obligations, but by the universal force of gravity. They are attracted and repelled to one another, not by the will of the Almighty, but through the interaction of force and counterforce. Finally, they are ordered not through decree, but through the invisible power of equilibrating inertia. Now, this flat universe mirrors the flat ideals of liberal society. A liberal society consists of equally small actors or particles, none of which is large enough to affect the other particles' actors. These particle actors are energized not by patriarchal obligations, but by scarcity, which is the gravitational force of the social universe. They are attracted and repelled to one another, not by feudal obligations, but through the universal functions of supply and demand. And they obey not hierarchical rule, but the equilibrating forces of the invisible hand of perfect competition. So that's the second idea about the mechanical cosmos. The third foundation of political economy is the economic duality of real and nominal, and the value theory that links them together. Capitalism is a system of commodities, and as such, it is denominated in the universal units of price. To understand the nature and dynamic of that architecture, we need to understand prices. And that is why both liberals and Marxists founded their theories on theories of value, the utility theory of value and the labor theory of value. Now, value theories begin by splitting the economy itself into two parallel quantitative spheres, the real and the nominal. The key, of course, is the real sphere. This is where production and consumption take place, where supply and demand interact, where utility and productivity are determined, where power and equilibrium compete, where well-being and exploitation take place, where surplus value and profit are generated. Now, on the face of it, it seems difficult to quantify the real sphere. Why is it difficult to quantify the real sphere? Because the entities of this sphere are qualitatively different, and that qualitative difference makes them incommensurate. But this problem, say the economist, is more apparent than real. Physicists and chemists express all measurement in terms of five fundamental quantities: distance, time, mass, electrical charge, and heat. In this way, velocity can be defined as distance divided by time. Acceleration is the time derivative of velocity. Force is mass times acceleration, etc. Now, according to the economist, they are able to do the very same thing. They too have fundamental quantities. The fundamental quantity of the liberal universe is the util, and the fundamental quantity of the Marxist universe is socially necessary abstract labor. With these fundamental quantities, every real entity, be it concrete labor or a range of commodities or the capital stock, can be reduced to and expressed in the very same unit, either util or abstract labor. Now, parallel to this real sphere, there stands the nominal world of money and prices. This sphere constitutes the immediate appearance of the commodity system, but that is merely a derived appearance. In fact, the nominal sphere is nothing but a giant symbolic mirror. It's a parallel arena. It's an arena whose universal dollar magnitudes merely reflect, sometimes accurately, sometimes inaccurately, the underlying real util and labor quantities of production and consumption. So we have a quantitative correspondence. The nominal sphere of prices reflects the real sphere of production. And the purpose of value theory is to explain this reflection correspondence. How does value theory sort out this correspondence? In the liberal version, the double-sided economy is assumed to be contained in a Newtonian-like space. In other words, in a container that comes complete with its own invisible laws or functions that equilibrate quantities and prices. The Marxist version is very different in that it emphasizes not equilibrium and harmony, but the conflictual dialectical engine of the economy. However, here too there is a clear bifurcation between the real and the nominal. And there is an assumed set of laws, the historical laws of motion, that govern the long-term interaction of these two spheres. Now, the role of the political economist in all of that is merely to discover these principles. And the method of discovery builds on the research paradigm of Galileo, Descartes, and Newton on the one hand, and on the application of probability and statistics on the other. In this method, discovery takes place through a fusion of experimentation and generalization, a method the liberals carry through testing and prediction, and that Marxists undertake through the dialectics of theory and praxis. Finally, unlike economics, politics doesn't have its own intrinsic laws. In the liberal case, the self-optimizing nature of the economy means that political intervention can only lead to suboptimal results, because you already start from an optimal structure. In the Marxist case, politics and state are inextricably bound up with the production process and with the economy. However, since politics and state have no rules of their own, they have to derive their logic from the economy, and they do so either strictly, as argued by structuralist Marxists, or they do so loosely, as argued by instrumentalist Marxists. Now let me sum up. The cosmology of capitalism is built on three key foundations, we argue. The first foundation is the separation between economics and politics. The economy is governed by its own laws, whereas politics is either derived from these economic laws or distorts them. That's the first. The second foundation is a mechanical view of the economy itself, a view based on action and reaction, flat functions, and the self-regulating forces of motion and equilibrium. The role of the political economist in this context is merely to discover these mechanical laws. That's the second one. The third one is the bifurcation of the economy itself into two quantitative spheres, real and nominal. The real sphere is enumerated in material units of consumption and production. So these are the utils and the abstract labor. And the nominal sphere is counted in money prices, but these prices merely reflect the quantities of the real sphere. And the role of value theory is to explain this correspondence. So these are the three foundations. Now, these foundations of the capitalist cosmology started to disintegrate in the second half of the 19th century. The key reason for this disintegration, we argue, was the very victory of capitalism. Note that political economy differed from all earlier cosmologies in the sense that it was the first to substitute secular for religious force. But this secular force was assumed to be heteronomous, to follow Cornelius Castoriadis' language. It was an objective entity that was external to society. The victory of capitalism changed this perception. With the feudal order finally giving way to a capitalist regime, it became increasingly apparent that force is imposed not from without, but from within. Instead of heteronomous force, there emerged autonomous power. With autonomous power, the dualities of economics and politics, the separation of real and nominal, the mechanical worldview of political economy, were all seriously undermined. With these categories undermined, the presumed automaticity of political economy no longer held true, and with automaticity gone, political economy ceased to be a science. The recognition of power is affected by four important developments. Briefly, the first one was the emergence of totally new units. By the late 19th century and early 20th century, the notion of atomistic interdependent units had declined in lieu of large hierarchical organizations. We have big business, we have large unions, we have big governments, large NGOs. The second development was the emergence of many new phenomena that were largely unknown to the classical political economists. By the beginning of the 20th century, total war and a permanent war economy have been established as salient features of modern capitalism, features that seem to be no less important than production and consumption. Government started to actively engage in massive industrial and macro stabilization policies that completely upset the presumed automaticity of the so-called economic sphere. Capitalists incorporated their businesses and in the process bureaucratized and socialized the very process of accumulation. The singular act of labor grew not more homogeneous and simpler, but ever more complex, and workers no longer lived at subsistence. The emergence of labor aristocracy, the workers' standards of living in the main capitalist countries soared, and the rising disposable income essentially brought issues of culture to an importance similar to that of work. Finally, the nominal processes of inflation and finance assumed a life of their own, a process whose trajectory no longer seemed to reflect the so-called real sector. The third development was the emergence of totally new concepts. With the rise of fascism and Nazism, the primacy of class and production was increasingly challenged by a new emphasis on concepts such as mass, power, state, bureaucracy, elite, and, of course, systems. Fourth and finally, the objective mechanical cosmology of the first political scientific revolution was challenged by uncertainty, by relativity, and by the entanglement of subject and object. Science was increasingly challenged by anti-scientism, by vitalism, and by postism. Now, the combined result of these developments was a growing divergence between universality and fracture. On the one hand, the regime of capital has become the most universal system ever to organize society. Its rule spread to every corner of the world and incorporated more and more aspects of human life. On the other hand, political economy, the cosmology of that order, was fatally fractured. Instead of what once was an integrated science of society, there emerged a collection of partial and exclusionary social disciplines. The mainstream liberal study of society was split into numerous social sciences. These social sciences, economics, political science, sociology, anthropology, psychology, and now also culture, gender, and other such offshoots, are each treated as a rigid discipline, a closed system with its own jargon, its own principles, and its own bureaucratic academic hierarchy. But this fracturing didn't really save economics. The rise of autonomous power destroyed the fundamental quantities of economics. For and foremost, it made it patently clear that utils and abstract labor were both logically impossible and empirically unknowable. And indeed, no liberal economist has ever been able to measure the util contents of commodities, and no Marxist has ever been able to calculate abstract labor time. This inability is existential. With no fundamental quantities, value theory becomes impossible. And with no value theory, economics disintegrates. The neoclassicists responded by turning their economics into a null domain. In order to avoid the destructive effect of power, they have withdrawn into the heavily subsidized fantasy world of perfect competition and equilibrium, where everything still works exactly as it should. To achieve that end, though, they had to exclude from their domain almost every meaningful phenomenon, and they have done it so thoroughly that their theory now perfectly explains next to nothing. And when the reality still clashes with the theory, which is nearly always the case, the solution is to blame it all on micro distortions and imperfections, and on macro interventions and shocks. Now, unlike the neoclassicist, Marxist addressed power head on. But this trajectory destroyed the original unity of Marxist theory. To recognize power meant to abandon the labor theory of value. But since Marxists never came up with another theory of value, their worldview lost its main unifying force. The net result was a neo-Marxist fracture. Marxism today consists of three sub-disciplines, each of which has its own categories, its own logic, and its own bureaucratic demarcations. The first sub-discipline is a neo-Marxian economics based on a mixture of monopoly capital and permanent government intervention. The second sub-discipline is a neo-Marxian critique of capitalist culture. And the third one is neo-Marxist theory of the state. Now, let me stress that Marx and the neo-Marxists have had very meaningful things to say about the world. For example, the notion of capitalism as a political power regime, which Marx was the first to emphasize. The universalizing, globalizing tendencies of this regime, you know, way before people started to talk about globalization. The dialectics of the class struggle. The fight against exploitation, oppression, and imperial rule. The quest for autonomy and dignity. These are all indispensable steps that we build on. More importantly, the development of these ideas is deeply enfolded, to use David Bohm's term, in the very history of the capitalist regime. And in that sense, these ideas can never be discarded as erroneous because they are embedded in the history of our thinking. But all of that still leaves one key question unresolved. In the absence of a value theory, there is no logically coherent and empirically meaningful way to explain the so-called accumulation of capital, let alone to account for how culture, how state, and other aspects of society presumably affect that accumulation. In other words, we have no explanation for the most important process of all, that is the accumulation of capital. But then capitalism remains a universalizing system. And a universalizing system calls for a universal theory. So maybe it's time to stop the fracturing. We don't need finer and finer nuances. We don't need new subdisciplines to be connected to interdisciplinary links. We don't need imperfections and distortions to tell us why our theories don't work. What we do need is a radical control alternate delete. As Descartes tells us, to be radical means to go to the root. And the root of capitalism is the accumulation of capital. So this then should be our new starting point. Now, in the remainder of my presentation, I'll try to very briefly outline some of the key elements of our own approach to capital. This outline is not comprehensive, it's simply suggestive. It is meant simply to tickle your imagination, to lure you to the rest of the panels, and perhaps to give you a reason to read further. Our starting point is power. We argue that capital is not means of production. It's not the ability to produce hedonic pleasure. It's not a quantum of some dead productive labor. Rather, capital is power and only power. Furthermore, and more broadly, we argue that capitalism is not a mode of production and consumption, but a mode of power. Machines, production, consumption, of course, are part of capitalism, and they certainly feature in accumulation. But the role of these entities in the process of accumulation, whatever that role may be, is significant primarily through the way they bear on power. Now, to explicate our argument, we begin with two related entities, prices and capitalization. Capitalism, we argue, and as we have already noted, and as both liberals and Marxists correctly recognize, is organized as a system of commodities denominated in prices. Now, capitalism is particularly conducive to numerical organization because it is based on private ownership. And anything that can be privately owned can be priced. This situation means that as private ownership spreads over space and deep into society, prices become the universal numerical unit with which the capitalist order is organized. Now, the actual pattern of this order is created through capitalization. Capitalization, to paraphrase again physicist David Bohm, is the generative order of capitalism. It is the flexible and all-inclusive algorithm or fractal that creorders, in other words, that continuously creates the order of capitalism. What exactly is capitalization? Capitalization is a symbolic financial entity. It's the discounting to the present value of risk-adjusted expected future earnings. The principles of capitalization have had a long gestation period. They first emerged in the Italian city-states of the 14th century. They were systematically articulated about a century ago, and they became the old dominant ritual of capitalism around the 1950s when they started to appear in textbooks. Now, as Ulf Martin will explain later today, capitalization is an operational computational symbol. Unlike ontological symbols, capitalization isn't a passive representation of the world. Instead, it's an active synthetic calculation. It is a symbol that human beings create and impose on the world, and in so doing, shape the world in the image of that symbol. Capitalists, as well as everyone else, are conditioned to think of capital as capitalization and nothing but capitalization. The ultimate question is not the particular entity that the capitalist owns, but the universal worth of this entity defined as a capitalist asset. Now, neoclassicists and Marxists, of course, recognize this symbolic creature. But given that, in their view, capital is a real economic entity, they don't quite know what to do with this symbolic creature. The neoclassicists bypass the impasse by saying that, in principle, capitalization is merely the image of real capital, but that, in practice, this image gets constantly distorted by unfortunate market imperfections. The Marxists approach the problem from exactly the opposite direction. They begin following Marx by assuming that capitalization is entirely fictitious and therefore totally unrelated to real capital. But then, in order to sustain their labor theory of value, they also insist that occasionally this fiction must crash into equality with real capital. Now, in our view, these attempts to make capitalization fit the box of real capital are an exercise in futility. As we already saw, not only does real capital lack an objective quantity, but the very duality between economics and politics has become defunct. And indeed, capitalization is hardly limited to the so-called economic sphere. In principle, every stream of expected income is a candidate for capitalization. And since income streams are generated by social entities, by social processes, by social organizations and social institutions, we end up with capitalization discounting not the so-called sphere of economics, but discounting potentially every aspect of society. Take human life. It's discounted, including its social habits and its genetic code, routinely. Institutions, from education and entertainment to religion to the law, are habitually capitalized. Voluntary social networks, urban violence, civil war, international conflict are regularly capitalized. Even the environmental future of our own humanity is capitalized. Nothing escapes the eyes of the discounters. If it generates future income, it can be capitalized. Now, the encompassing nature of capitalization calls for an encompassing theory, and the unifying basis for such a theory, we argue, is power. The primacy of power, why do we insist on power, is built right into the definition of private ownership. Note that the English word private comes from the Latin word privatus, which means restricted, and from privare, which means to deprive. In this sense, private ownership is wholly and only an act of exclusion. And institutional exclusion is a matter of organized power. Of course, exclusion does not have to be exercised. What matters here is the right to exclude and the ability to exact pecuniary terms for not exercising that right. This right and ability, we argue, are the foundations of accumulation. So capital, in our view, is nothing but organized power. This power has two sides, one qualitative, the other quantitative. The qualitative side comprises the institutions, the processes, and conflicts through which capitalists constantly reorder society, through which they shape and restrict the trajectory of society in order to exact the tribute income. The quantitative side of the process, the side that integrates, that reduces, that distills these numerous qualitative processes down to the symbolic magnitude of capitalization, is the other aspect of capitalization. So you have quality versus quantity. Now, what is the object of capitalist power? How does capitalist power reorder society? The answer begins with a conceptual distinction between the creative, productive potential of society, the sphere that Thorsten Veblen called industry, and the realm of power, which in the capitalist epoch takes the form of business. Using as a metaphor the concept of physicist Denis Gabor, we can think of the social process as a giant hologram, and I'm going to speak about that later on in the panels, the subsequent panels. A giant hologram, which essentially is, in this case, a space that is crisscrossed with incidental waves. Now, each social action, whether it's an act of industry or an act of business, is an event, an occurrence that generates vibrations throughout space. But there is a fundamental difference between the vibrations of industry and the vibrations of business. Industry, when understood in its totality as a collective body of knowledge and a collective effort of humanity, is inherently cooperative, integrated, and synchronized. It operates best when its various events resonate with each other. Business, on the other hand, isn't collective, it's private by definition. Its goals are achieved through the threat and through the exercise of systemic prevention and restriction, that is, through strategic sabotage. The key object of this sabotage is the resonating pulses of industry, a resonance that business constantly upsets to build in dissonance. Now, let me try to illustrate the interaction of business and industry with a simple example that is taken from our book. Okay. That's too big. Okay. Listen to that. It's in your handout. Political economists, both mainstream and Marxist, postulate a positive linear relationship between production and profit. Capitalists, the argument goes, benefit from industrial activity. And therefore, the more fully employed their equipment and workers are, the greater their profit. But if we think of capital as power exercised through the strategic sabotage of industry by business, the relationship would be nonlinear. This latter relationship is illustrated in this first chart. It's a hypothetical chart. The chart depicts the utilization of industrial capacity on the horizontal axis against the capitalist share of income on the vertical axis. Now, up to a point, the two move together. After that point, the relationship becomes negative. The reason is easy to explain by looking at extremes. If industry comes to a complete standstill at the bottom left corner of the chart, capitalist earnings would be nil. But capitalist earnings would also be zero if industry always and everywhere operated at full technological capacity, depicted by the bottom right corner of the chart. Now, under this latter scenario that I just mentioned, industrial considerations rather than business decisions would be paramount. Production no longer would need the consent of owners, and these owners would then be unable to extract the tribute earnings. For owners of capital, then, the ideal condition indicated by the top arc segment lies somewhere in between, with high capitalist earnings being received in return for letting industry operate, though only at less than full potential. In other words, strategic sabotage. Now, having laid out the theory, let's work on the facts. The second figure shows the relationship of these two considerations for the United States since the 1930s. The horizontal axis approximates the degree of sabotage by using the official rate of unemployment inverted. Notice that the unemployment rate begins with zero on the right, indicating no sabotage. And as it increases to the left, so does sabotage. The vertical axis, as before, shows the share of capitalists in national income, in this case, profit and interest. Now, lo and behold, what we see is quite close to the theoretical claims made in Figure 1. The best position for capitalists is not when industry is fully employed, but when the unemployment rate is around 7%. In other words, what economists call the natural or the normal rate of unemployment, and what financiers call business as usual, are two sides of the same power process, a process in which business accumulates by strategically sabotaging industry, by inserting dissonance into resonance. Now, power is never absolute. It's always relative. For this reason, both the quantitative and qualitative aspects of capital accumulation have to be assessed differentially. In other words, relative to other capitalists. Contrary to standard political economy, both liberal and Marxist, capitalists are driven not to maximize profits, but to beat the average and exceed the normal rate of return. Their entire existence is conditioned by the need to outperform, by the imperative of achieving not absolute accumulation, but differential accumulation. And that makes quite a bit of sense, because to beat the average means to accumulate faster than other capitalists. And since capital is power, according to what we argue, capitalists who accumulate differentially end up increasing their power. Now let's illustrate this process with another example taken from our work on the Middle East. This third figure, and last in your handout, shows the differential performance of the world's six leading oil companies relative to the Fortune 500 benchmark. Each bar in this chart shows you the extent to which the oil company's rate of return on equity exceeds or falls short of the Fortune 500 average. The gray bars show positive differential accumulation. In other words, they show the percentage by which the oil companies exceeded the Fortune 500, and it's expressed in relative terms. You can read it in the footnotes. The black bars show negative differential accumulation. In other words, the percent by which the oil companies trailed the average. Finally, the little explosion, the nasty symbols there, show the occurrences of energy conflicts, that is, regional energy-related wars. Now, conventional economics has really no interest in the differential profits of the oil companies, and certainly it has nothing to say about the relationship between these differential profits and regional wars. Differential profit is perhaps of some interest to financial analysts. Middle East wars are the business of experts in international relations and security analysts. And since each phenomenon belongs to a completely separate realm of society, no one has ever thought of relating them in the first place. So this is the first time. If you haven't seen this before in our work, you haven't seen it. And yet it turns out that these phenomena are not simply related. In fact, they could be thought of as two sides of the very same process, namely the global accumulation of capital as power. Now, we started to study this subject when we were still young graduate students back in the late 1980s, and we have published quite a bit about this subject since then. Now, this research opened our eyes to two things. First, to the encompassing nature of capital, and second, to the insight that one can gain from analyzing its accumulation as a power process. Notice three remarkable relationships depicted in the chart. First, every energy conflict was preceded by the large oil companies trailing the average. In other words, for an energy conflict to erupt, the oil companies first had to differentially decumulate. A very unusual, I would say a most unusual prerequisite from the viewpoint of any social science. Second, every energy conflict was followed by the oil companies beating the average. In other words, war and conflict in the Middle East, which social scientists customarily blame for distorting the aggregate economy, the global economy, etc., these wars have served the differential interest of certain key groups of firms at the expense of other key groups of firms. Third and finally, with only one exception in 96-97, it's nice to have an exception because then people don't blame you for doctoring the data. With one exception, the oil companies never managed to beat the average without there being an energy conflict in the region first. In other words, the differential performance of the oil companies depended not on production, but on the most extreme form of sabotage, war. Needless to say, these relationships and the conclusions they give rise to are nothing short of remarkable. First, the likelihood that all three patterns are the consequence of a statistical fluke is really very, very negligible. In other words, there must be something very substantive behind the connection of Middle East wars on the one hand and global differential profits on the other hand. Second, these relationships seamlessly fuse quality and quantity. In our research on the subject, and what you see is just a graph, but we have published quite a bit of work on it. In this research, we showed how the qualitative aspects of international relations, of superpower confrontation, of regional conflicts, of the activities of the oil and armament companies on the one hand, both explained and do explain the quantitative global processes of capital accumulation. So we have quantity and quality really fused in a very effective way. At least that's what we think. Third, all three relationships have remained stable over nearly half a century, allowing us to predict in writing and before the event both the first and the second Gulf Wars. Now, this stability suggests that the patterns of capital as power, although subject to historical change and change from within society, are anything but haphazard. They have a structure. I'm going to finish soon. Mm-hmm. This type of research has gradually led us to the conclusion that political economy really requires a control alternate delete. At about the same time that we were doing this early research, in 1991, Paul Sweezy, one of the greatest American Marxists, at least in our view, wrote a piece that assessed his book, Monopoly Capital, that he co-published with Paul Baran 25 years earlier. He called it Monopoly Capital 25 years later, or after. Now, in that piece, Sweezy admitted that there is something very big missing from both the Marxist and neoclassical theories of capital. And he said that until that problem is resolved, political economy will remain stuck. This is 1991. We came to know that only later. In our view, Sweezy was unable to solve the problem because he was locked into the old framework. And he readily admitted that he had no idea how to get political economy unstuck. So he said, I don't know how to solve this problem, but I'm sure it has to be solved because otherwise we cannot move forward. But we were young. He was older. We came with a fresh view, not burdened by this, you know, heavy past. And we applied the control onto the delete that Descartes recommends. In our view, the solution to this problem is to view capitalism not as a mode of production and consumption that is affected by other things, but as a much broader framework to view capital and capitalism as a mode of power. And that is what our book tries to do. So I will stop here. Thank you very much.
Yes, thank you. Okay, so any questions, please?
Nobody? Oh, yes. Well, give them some time.
Can you just say why the exception?
Why the exception?
Yeah, that shows you're not cooking the dad.
I don't know what the exception. I really haven't investigated it very closely. You see, for that you have to start looking at oil prices and how oil prices were jittery in that time and figure out. Now, I'm not saying that this is a natural law. I'm discovering here a certain pattern that I think is very well explained by power relations, and that certainly calls for further investigation. Mind you, the jump here in that period indicated by the arrow is fairly small. Also, mind you, that you can measure differential accumulation in different ways. In other words, this particular measure is arbitrary in a sense that you can measure it in, you know, using different proxies. So, for instance, instead of return on equity, you can look at the growth rates of profits or the growth rates of capitalization. You might get slightly different results. I've done that with growth rates of profits, and it's very, very consistent. But I've done that with other measurements, and it's less consistent. So, you know, the picture is not perfect. It's very fuzzy. And the fact that we are able to get such a clear picture that continues to hold, in other words, much of what has happened up until here was unknown to us when we started this work. So the subsequent predictions actually were born correct by events. But you know, I wouldn't venture to say something about a question that I never researched. So your question is well put. I don't know the correct answer to that question or the enlightening answer to that question. If you were a student, I would say, you know, write a paper on it.
Back there? Yeah.
I know we're just getting started with this, but I'd like more elaboration about this, the way you define power. And I noticed before you were talking about power as, you know, a kind of mechanism of control, the ability to exclude. You also said that it doesn't have to exclude, it can include, but at a price. And I'm thinking about this issue of power in relation to more traditional categories of the various kinds of property relations that exist between persons, so that there are some relations that are more focused on the exclusionary end, as when you talk about, say, property that's used for personal consumption, and relations that involve inclusion at a price, so that, for example, if you're going to talk about productive property, you're going to talk about inviting others to enter into a category of power, for the substitution, for the notion of socially necessary labor time, amounts to a more abstract rather than a less abstract category. And I wonder how to get a handle on what power is actually supposed to signify here that makes the situation special, because it seems like the net result of this is what you're doing is collapsing the distinction between the political and the economic, and in the end everything becomes political in the sense that everything is power. And it almost starts, you know, the first name that comes to mind is Foucault. And so I mean, I'm just trying to, this is my first attempt at trying to put together, you know, what you guys are doing.
Okay. Marcuse writes on Hegel that force is nothing but its effect. So, you know, when you think of, say, Newton speaking about gravity, gravity is something we don't know. We know it because Newton says that gravity essentially is defined as the product of mass, two masses, divided by the square of the distance. And what he says is, I will take this formula and I will show you that this is force in the world. In other words, I will use this formula to explain every phenomenon in the universe. So for Newton, and I think for all science and for everything we do, power is nothing but its effect. There is a miracle and you start walking. What is it? It's God, right? So God is nothing but the effect of God. We are doing the same thing. We are basically suggesting that in every prior historical regime, prices were determined by some mixture of cooperation and power. You know, if you take contemporary regimes such as, you know, communist Russia, Soviet Union, or Nazi regimes, or any, you know, authoritarian regime, prices are determined by decree. So what would be the theory of price in those regimes? It will be a theory of power. It's quite obvious, and we never contest it. I would say the same thing here. What we can do, though, is we can never move back to the notion that there is some sort of an objective entity out there that determines power. We have to reason that qualitatively. But in the mind of the capitalists, and that's very important because that mind is imposed on all of us, power is nothing but its effect. For them, they judge power by their success, by their differential accumulation. And they know, if I do this, this will happen. If I do this, I have no idea what will happen. So the second one is not power. The first one is power. And what we are trying to build is a system of thinking of how we can relate the qualitative quantitative from the viewpoint of power. It becomes power. It becomes force if we are persuasive. No, it's not instrumentalism, but it's certainly operationalism, and Ulf Martin is going to speak about it in the next panel. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah, you were first.
I'd like to take off.
Can you speak up?
Yeah, it's there's
I'd like to take off on his question when he introduced Foucault. I very much, because of my own personal feelings and the Jupiter converted, where you began by talking about the trifurcation of various strands of Marxian thought. But, you know, I didn't catch it, maybe it wasn't my fault, but there are two other realms that, you know, very much speak to the questions of power, the Gramscian and the structuralist, the Althusserian. And, you know, this conference has something to do with the Althusserian crowd. So where would those notions of capitally or economically derived cultural power or cultural power to sustain the economic, spoken in Gramscian, tie to questions of power that you're dealing with?
Well, I think that the approaches that you mentioned are precisely fitting into that trifurcation. Essentially, accumulation is an economic process that is affected by something outside of it. So, you know, ask any Marxist, and the answer would be one of two. Either I believe in the labor theory of value, and that labor theory of value then gets distorted by events and power relations that come from other spheres, or I have no theory of value whatsoever. What we are trying to say is, instead of thinking of accumulation as being part of that economic entity affected by institutions and processes of power that lie outside of it, that is a complete inversion of the way in which capitalization actually works. Capitalization includes those power relationships that you describe as if they are outside, they're already included in the process. So this is not a negation of speaking about power, say, from a Gramscian perspective. It simply is to say that there is no reason from the viewpoint of capital to separate these spheres as lying outside. You can analyze culture separately. I have no doubt you can do that. But from a unified perspective of the capitalist regime, culture becomes enfolded, becomes included in the process of capitalization. So in that sense, I think it's an abolition of these alternative approaches insofar as they create a fracture in our thinking. It's not the abolition of the subjects that they deal with. We still can deal with these subjects. So, for instance, Troy is going to present a paper on the power of love, is it? Yeah. So essentially it's about the accumulation process by De Beers and how they institutionalized love, relating it with diamonds, and how that affected the process of accumulation. So in that sense, these aspects are included, embedded, encompassed in the process of accumulation. I think that this is inclusive of the approaches that you suggested or indicated, and I'm not trying to criticize them, although I have my critiques of them. I'm just saying that the subject matter actually gets absorbed into capitalization.
Yes.
Okay. What I'm looking at, I can see that someone who comes from the neoclassical tradition who looks at something through the lens of, for example, Mansrolls and rent-seeking can say, well, I see what you have here, and this is an example of rent-seeking. It's where the benefits for these people come at some cost to society. There still is within this utilitarian framework, more is better. But I'm hearing you say something that I think is a little bit different, and I just want to clarify, is what you're saying is what matters is not the absolute rate of profit, that capitalists will take a lower rate of profit so long as their rate of profit is superior to all other groups within society. So what matters then isn't the absolute, it's mm-hmm. the relative.
Correct.
Okay, so.
Yes. In fact, what you see here does not actually show the actual rates of return on equity, but in many cases, both have gone down. Okay. However, the rate of return on for the old companies was higher than the rate of return for the average, and therefore it was positive. So we, in our work on it, we actually went step by step and kind of built it, and to show you that in fact it's not about absolute profit. This is not a mimic of absolute profit. In fact, it is differential and it is very, very different. And I've worked for a number of years in the private sector as an editor of a financial publication. And in that stretch of time, I came to the firm conclusion that this idea of differential is the only thing that counts. And this is by observing people who think as financiers or think for the financiers. So they have absolute no concern for absolute measurements. They have no idea what absolute measurements are. They always benchmark against some sort of an average. And that's not just with rates of return. That is with their opinions as well. You know, think about publications such as Consensus Forecast. So essentially you collect the opinions of people and you build distribution and you say, where am I relative to that distribution about any issue? So it's all benchmarked against the average of my own group. The spread is not very big. In fact, the spread is very thin. And these people are usually on the phone with each other almost daily. You know, what do you think about this? What do you think about that? So it's like a big magnet that, you know, pulls the edges of the distribution very close together. But it's always, always differential. It always is relative. It's always whether I outperform or underperform. You know, you come in the morning, you log into Bloomberg, and you check that. So, yes, you are right on the spot here, I think.
So, I think it's 20 past, and
yeah,
it's exactly the time where we're supposed to finish. And since there's no more question anyway, so I think we have a break of 10 minutes, and then in this room, the second round of discussion.
Right, thank you. You got it?